So my sort of conceit for this hour is that I'm actually going to use the clock. How many people know, have seen this? Have you guys seen this clock? This is the public radio clock. I think this is the specials clock, which actually, in a way, we're usually fighting against because it feels like one of these structures that we've now sort of forced down the throats of all producers and all people programming against time. But it's actually remarkably fruitful because it's allowed for this structure of local and national to interweave in some ways that I think actually our internet presence hasn't yet figured out. But so for today, I'm going to be trying to talk at least through segment B, and then usually we go to calls, and that'll be you guys going to calls. We'll start off with the billboard, and then we'll head through the newscasts. I don't think I have all this stuff, but we'll try it. So the notion is that I'm talking about public radio in this case, not public media writ large. Sometimes we talk about public media and make that kind of a interpretation, a definition we have to define each time about where the concentric circles are. I want to talk about public radio. Public television has some of its own fate to handle, and in some ways is worse off. In many ways, it's worse off. It's facing some real difficulties. We're tethered in some ways. Our fates are intertwined. We won't always be able to disentangle them. But in a short form, in the sort of billboard treatment of this, public radio's audiences are growing. We've had some remarkable digital success. There's some real innovations taking place at the national and the local level. Our content is strong. There's a sort of diverse new content showing up. We're creating podcasts. We're creating new national shows. I think the pipeline of shows has started to unfold a little bit more. We're doing interesting things in culture and in music. Local stations like here at KUT in Austin does some unbelievable stuff with performance. And actually, interestingly, our business models have been somewhat durable. We've talked about this, the fact that, you know, since we didn't have a classifieds, Craigslist, newspaper, single source risk, we've got this weird mix. We sort of made a virtue out of a necessity, which is a mix of federal funding and state funding and philanthropy and major donors and local underwriting and voluntary giving. And that's sort of been durable. It's actually meant that we haven't had the same sort of push off the cliff yet. But also faces some fundamental challenges, which we're going to talk a little bit about. Threats to federal funding, the politicization, the politics that we've really hit upon, especially in our journalism on the national level, and the disruption and competition that are facing us, as well as dramatically changing consumer habits around access to content. While we can look at the kind of continuous growth of public radio audiences from its inception 40 years ago, it's still only reaching 10% of the country. And for a service that aspires to and has almost in its spirit the notion of serving all Americans, that's not very successful if you're reaching 10%. It's a lot better than 0% and 1%, which it started, and 2%, which it became, but still just doesn't feel like we're living up to our own aspirations. But in thinking about some of these sort of qualities of public radio that are succeeding, that are challenged, and then coming to a conference like this, it just seemed like we had an opportunity. I wanted to have a discussion about the things that we could distill, the sort of methods to our madness that might actually hold some lessons. And some of them are metaphors and sort of concepts. How, as a media industry, are we doing things that the internet, which is in its still early years of becoming a media enterprise, could learn from? Things that perhaps new media companies and startups who are building the tools or actually creating content might learn from public radio, or perhaps want to partner with us to do, or help us actually create those things that could grow beyond the 10% reach that we have. And I worry a little bit about, you know, the current state of just assumptions that the platforms we now see as the public square, Google and Facebook and Twitter in particular, where we think now that's where discussion and civil interaction happens, those are pretty tenuous. There was a reason 45 years ago in an era of media scarcity that there was a set aside and an actual conscious effort to create non-commercial space. That ain't going to happen again on the internet. And so I think it's up to public radio and public media to figure out how to actually inform, influence, and grow into that in a more dramatic way. So partly this is a call to us at a conference like this to step up and not suffer from this kind of underdog complex that I talked a little bit about yesterday, where I feel like we've got this conundrum of a superiority complex combined with the inferiority complex. Superiority complex being that our mission is transcendent and it's essential to the functioning of democracy itself, and then inferiority complex being that we're the perpetual media underdog and we're kind of scrappy and we're kind of just always playing second fiddle. And it's painful often at the digital conferences because we look like we're just catching up to the last wave of tools that everybody else already figured out 5 years ago, and we should be actually inventing the next ones and propelling ourselves forward. So this is also just clearly my own fixation because I love public radio. I love the internet. I've always felt they could learn a lot from each other and aren't as much as they could. So the conceit for this also has been I just wanted to come up with a SEO-friendly blog title for the session, which would be something like 5 things public radio can teach the internet. Don't necessarily have 5, might be more, might be less, but it seems like it's always 5. And if I was really going for page clicks, it would just be a slideshow embedded in the page that you would all have to click through to watch. So again, if you have more than 5, here's one. Yeah, tweet them to me at Jake Shapiro, and I will add them to my list as we go. So I'm going to just tick through them fast and then return to them at greater length. So number one, have a mission. I think that is probably good advice. Number two would be tell a story. Kind of embedded in that, I want to get a little bit about it, like make a sound. There's something about audio in that I think is important. That's number three, which is curate. Number four is broadcast, which I'm using somewhat metaphorically there too. Number five is ask for money. I think we do that pretty well. Number six, I did not come up with one for this, but I just love that image, and I wanted, you guys need to just tell me what that one should be.
Take risks.
Take risks, that's good. Be dangerous, somebody said.
Shock.
Just shock as a lesson, that's good. Could be something about portable, take it with you. Okay. I don't know. Okay, so we've made it through, I think. Now we're heading into the newscast. So first, the news. The news, this has been a year, just if you remember, this has been quite a year in public radio. So it started off a year and a half ago or so with that whole Juan Williams debacle, followed by the James O'Keefe mess and triggering the federal funding fight and, you know, various executives at NPR being fired or retired. Basically led into this perilous period where the federal funding, triggered by the backdrop of the deficit and federal cuts and state cuts on the state level, has meant that the actual existential question of the core linchpin of funding for public media, public broadcasting, has been called into question. And then, as a result, the existential question of why do we need this to begin with? It's a pretty big deal. It doesn't happen that often that you get that close to the bone and are forced to actually have those kinds of questions. And unfortunately, I feel it was a missed opportunity to actually have a kind of interesting conversation about the meaning of a public stake in a media enterprise in today's age. And it mostly just got caught up in the politics of the moment. And that's not far away. It'll come back again. But when we think about the actual kind of context of what's been happening, we got to remember what this fight has been about. And I think it was good to hear Gary Nell the other day. He came here, the new CEO of NPR, and spoke at the IMA conference. You know, I think he's got a fundamental story about the education and news and informational role and the federal and local relationship in a way that I think, you know, his years on Capitol Hill will bear fruit and he'll probably be able to hold on. But that is not over. So the other things that have been going on in the news, there's been innovation. I mean, I think NPR's move to get the in-dash car happening, the connected car thing, was, you know, both a tactical advantage and symbolically important for public radio, in this case under NPR's brand, which has some issues. But to have public radio leap into that space, anchor it in a way where if it wasn't us, it would just be, you know, CNN and Pandora and others, and demonstrating both that we have, when possible, an ability to keep pace, if not lead, and that there's sufficient broad consumer interest in this kind of a format that Ford would want to have it stuck in the dashboard. I, for one, don't actually think I would ever use that kind of... I'm just going to use my phone. I'm going to bring it in and plug it in the little mini jack, in which case we all have content in the car. But these kinds of things are being developed. PRX itself has released the KCRW Music Mine app, building, I think, some really fantastic and truly at kind of cutting edge apps overall. And, you know, we're not alone in doing that. I think that that's another facet of public radio showing that it's not just playing catch up, but it's actually at the leading edge, where some of the things that we can build transform the nature of the user experience of public radio and compete at a top level. Podcasts on iTunes, a bunch of them, I don't know how many, maybe four of the top 10 are public radio, which is remarkable. This is the scary graph I showed at the IMA conference. So back to that federal funding worry, the other bit of news, as we're doing the news section here, is that the digital dollars for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting were cut. So even as the core budget of CPB was preserved, pretty much, they lost a few other things around the edges, the sort of around $450 million a year still coming into the coffers. This money was the only money that was fueling some potential R&D and technology innovation in public broadcasting as a whole, and public radio was benefiting from that. A number of projects, some of ours included, were being funded in part through that was leveraging other money. Now, a lot of that money early on was going to hardware for the transit, you know, for public television, for example, which had a mandate to switch to digital broadcast. And a lot of it was going to HD radio. How many people have listened to HD radio? I see three people have listened to it. Four, five people have listened to HD. I mean, like on an HD device. That's now just two people. I think out of that money, there was probably, and somebody hidden in the room might be able to actually know this, maybe $150 million went to help HD radio get going. Bruce, is that close to correct? It's in the right zone. It's in that order of magnitude, went to build out the capacity for radio stations to have HD transmitters to do digital broadcasts to send to HD devices that nobody has or wants bought. Painful, because imagine, especially at that scale, and this is another kind of lesson of the sort of mismatch between the digital opportunity and what public radio can do, the scale of that kind of funding in a digital environment where we are now able to build lean startups and try things and learn and build experiments at a fraction of the cost could have gone a long way. So that's kind of grim. It's a grim bit of news. Maybe there's a case to be made to bring it back, but it means that as we think going forward about what's next for innovation on the digital side, in particular for public radio, we're going to be working with a lot less of CPB's support. By the way, if there's any question about that piece, this wasn't kind of an important one, so either hold it for later or try to get me. What I'd said before is that underscoring that, of course, is this notion that federal funding as a whole might be threatened, and even though we made it through with the skin of our teeth, there's this notion that the system is overbuilt. For today's media environment. We don't need hundreds of institutions locally that are broadcasting the same stuff at the same facilities. So at some point, Congress, even though it sort of let us pass, is going to take a look at that and say, you got to change this if we're going to have public media going forward. It can't be configured this way. And we either figure that out ourselves, and it's going to be people like you in this room taking some hard decisions and being strategic about what is the new efficiency, what's the way to use digital to get this right, or it's just going to be done to us, and they're going to say, okay, you have to do this, and you're only going to get this much funding to do that. That all leads to what I think of as this innovator's dilemma, which, as I was saying about the funding picture, we've mostly resisted. Like, we haven't been in the place where digital music has gone down, dramatically because of file sharing and the move to digital sales. Partly it's because our content just isn't popular enough. Nobody wants to steal it, damn them. I mean, if they did... we've thought about this, if file sharing has not been our problem. In fact, for a little while, we were contemplating setting up a file sharing, just seeding public radio shows into the file sharing networks, maybe misnaming them as Lady Gaga tracks so that people would listen without realizing it. But we haven't really had that problem. And actually, this is one of those interesting bits where public radio has actually had more advantage, because unlike television, we don't have a DVD market that we're worried about undermining. So, all these TV shows, first of all, TV shows have all these messy rights agreements. There's like four owners of every TV program, and all of them can say no, and none of them can say yes about distributing it digitally. Public radio actually has pretty clean ownership over, like, you know, NPR produced that, an independent producer who's this. If they say yes and they've cleared sufficient rights, they can put it out digitally. And putting it out for free doesn't mean that somebody might not buy the DVD version 6 months later for sale, because there is none. iTunes never became big enough retail sales of public radio tracks to be something that we would intentionally pull back our free distribution in order to earn money. So that's actually been good. It's meant that public radio was first out of the gate in podcasting. But, you know, this was one of my favorite images I've showed before, which is, like, you know, all of this combined makes me feel like we've got this Jenga tower where we're interlocked. So the sort of intermediated public broadcasting system is solely, completely interdependent. It's getting a little shaky. Nobody can do dramatic change because you might knock the whole tower over. And you know, we are at risk of being disintermediated. Okay, so moving right along. This is the section where I thank our funders. You know, we're moving out of the credits, out of the news, so I want to make sure to say that this hour is made possible by you, our listeners, for coming to the room, and these foundations. Is the clock thing working for everybody? You know that I'm going through the clock, right? And, you know, then you go to the weather, which sucks. It totally sucks, and it's going to suck for more days. It's freezing. I had no idea this is what Austin was supposed to be like. Don't like it. I know. Okay, thank you. And then we get a little musical interlude, I think. Usually there's, like, that little 30-second music bed. I love the music beds in public radio. And I hate the theme songs of public radio. So for some reason, the music beds are awesome. Like, the engineers get to choose them, and they're, like, 30 seconds long, and they're there all night, so they, like, find awesome music, and they cut them up into those little music beds. And those are great. But then whoever composes theme songs for shows is just, it's horrible. So, you know, just think of, like, Weekend Edition Sunday's theme song. I don't know if anybody can sing it. But I think what I've got here is, so, you know, we run this remix service, and we have some interstitials that we play as IDs, and I think one of them is queued up here. Let's see. This is my interstitial image.
Dear people of the Inland Northwest and world at large, I'm Roman Mars. That little tickle of panic that you're feeling is because you do not know what you're going to hear next. It's fun, isn't it?
You're listening to Public Radio Remix.
Stay tuned, or you'll miss it.
There's a road that curls before me. There's a road that curls.
So that's our remix format, which this hour is clearly starting to shape up just like, because you don't know what's coming next, and I'm not exactly sure I do either. So we're veering into segment A, and what I want to do is take a little detour to explain how I got into all this. I think it might be relevant. I'm hoping it is my story, because it sort of led to this obsession with these kinds of questions. It started off with being a captive listener in the backseat of our, you know, the 70s station wagon in Boston. I think I was predetermined. I was predestined, genetically determined to be a public radio listener as the son of a psychoanalyst and an ethnomusicologist. Like, I think that's, like, there was no escape. And we'd have, like, WGBH on in the car every day. And did anybody ever hear Robert J. Lertzimer? Anybody? Who knows? There's, like, two people. I can't do a good imitation. His voice is an octave lower, but he did the morning Pro Musica. You know, they had the birds tweeting in the morning. And then he'd do the news, but he'd take often 60-second pauses between... you just hear the birds tweeting. It was called Morning Pro Musica, but I've more recently been thinking that it should be called Morning Becomes Narcoleptic. That's been my... I think it was great. So that was my sort of beginning to public radio. But then most of what I was spending time doing in the 90s that led to all this is that I got into music. I'm a Korean rock star, and that's the end of the story. But the beginning of the story is that I played in a lot of rock bands. We were early internet adopters, so we had started a band in 96, and we had a friend at the MIT Media Lab who put our stuff up. We helped us encode it as MP3s. We had a website with our own mailing list. We were doing self-independent distribution. We were early adopters at that point, and I was convinced back then the music industry was about to collapse, and it was all going to be, you know, artists connecting to audiences, and it's still not quite that way. But we were trying hard then. In fact, in 1999, we were voted best band on the internet. I think it was a poll that all our friends voted for, but it was a great thing. And it was on mp3.com. Anybody remember mp3.com? So this was one of those first artists, sort of meant to be the place where internet artists would break without labels and become a thing. And they did one remarkable thing, which is only worth telling here in this setting at South By, which is that they did an IPO. You know this story? They went public. Everybody was going public. It was 1999. Every company was going public and blowing up. And they did a thing that I can't believe more aren't doing, but they offered all the bands who had accounts on the site at that time a chance to buy shares for the opening, for the IPO, which usually just goes to banks and insiders. But all these rock bands suddenly got an email being like, if you set up a Charles Schwab account, you can buy shares at the opening price. And so we did that. We cobbled together $1,000 or $2,000. It, you know, for to buy them at $25 a share, and they went up to 80, and we sold them, and we made like $30,000, and we bought a van, I bought a guitar. That was how we toured for the next 2 years. It was fantastic. Why don't more sites offer their users just shot in at the IPO? Facebook didn't do that. That would have been nice. So anyway, that was my introduction to not only the internet as this possible connecting tool for artists and audiences, but one of our songs took off. A song called Medicine became popular in South Korea. A record label signed us. We went touring over there not knowing what to expect, and that's what we got. We got thousands of people who actually loved our music and were singing the songs. And in fact, Korean bands are covering our songs and putting them on YouTube, and you can see the band is called, and this may be actually the secret to the whole thing, Two-Ton Shoe, which is a big, heavy shoe. But we think maybe it means like free beer in Korea or something. So anyway, I came back from playing in the band and from trying to make the internet the thing that would be the connecting tool for artists, and I needed a job, and I got one at WBUR. I'm working for this guy, Chris Lydon on the right, not the guy on the left, that's Marcel Marceau, which I just think is funny, because remember he was a guest. He's famous for mime, he's on the radio. I don't remember how they did that hour, but it was a good... So I got a job for a year working for the Connection. It wasn't supposed to be a year. It was supposed to be a lot longer than a year, but it was a year. It's a fateful year. But I fell in love with the whole thing. So Chris Lydon and Mary McGrath were kind of my radio parents, brought me under their wing. And it's a daily call-in talk show, nationally distributed at the time, first by PRI and then by NPR, which was part of the collapse at the end. And it was, you know, if you've ever had anybody work on a daily call-in talk show, it's awesome. It's great. There's several people. So it's adrenaline. You get to, you know, especially with this kind of public radio setting, which is, I think, another lesson. It's just intellectually omnivorous. You know, we were covering Marcel Marceau one day and then, like, the Hanging Chads the next day. And then we'd be doing, you know, international politics and then, you know, an author interview. And you do a deep dive on each one of them, figure out the best possible ways to talk about it in an hour. Invite callers on who actually in many cases were smarter than the guests, and then you move on to the next hour. And I sat there and I realized that this was, you know, this is the way it should be. This was conversation, this was inquiry, this was curiosity, this was education, it was information, but it was really entertaining. People loved it. And there were things that we did that were boring, but because Chris, as a really galvanizing host, was so insatiably curious about them himself, listeners would just listen because they found it fascinating. And I think we opened up the horizons for a lot of people who hadn't thought of those topics as ones they'd want to hear. And for me, that became this, you know, symbol of what public radio could potentially do. And it had this internet aspect to it even then. This is in 2001, where we didn't do much. We had a website. I think the stream was up or after the fact. But we started thinking of that setup where we'd create a space, have a topic, have a couple guests, have this host playing this role, and then have callers, which we actually, one of the things that was kind of the hazing ritual for being a producer at The Connection was to have to screen the calls, which you don't know, as a listener, if you don't realize that they do that. You sort of assume smart people are getting on the phone. And unfortunately, some shows don't do that. Those are the ones that you can tell. I think Talk of the Nation sometimes doesn't do that. But we did, and you know, this was the sort of internet comment moderation role built into the radio screening job. And it was a tough one. And once they actually made me pretend to be a caller, I have to admit it, it was bad, it was unethical, but we didn't have calls that hour, and I had to go to another studio and pretend to be a caller on the show. It can happen. I'm sure it wouldn't happen at today's BUR, but it happened back then. So actually, one of the things about my education into public radio during this show is that it ended in a big fight. The station management of the time and the hosts got in a big fight about the ownership of this show, partly because it was switching distributors. And Chris Lydon felt that he wasn't being brought into the conversation about its future and what audiences it was going to reach, and then the management didn't agree, and it exploded in this fireball of mutual recrimination and bad blood. And Chris and Mary were fired, and all of us quit the next day. And this was in February of 2001. And that, for me, was this, you know, so falling in love with the medium, learning about the business side of it, and figuring out what it would mean to do it independently. So we launched, right after that, our own independent web podcast show. Actually, it wasn't podcasting. It hadn't existed yet. This was webcasting. But we started to distribute it online. A few years later, that became the first podcasting, because Chris Lydon interviewing the people in the Howard Dean campaign, and Dave Weiner, who's the famous early RSS adopter of blogging, was at the Berkman Center, and he said, damn it, I just want to be able to get these MP3s in my feed rather than having to go to your webpage and download them. And he started putting Chris Lydon's talks into an RSS feed, and hence podcasting was born, which is pretty cool. So all of that led to two years later, the founding of PRX, where the founding of PRX, and the reason I wanted to detour into this just a little bit, is that for me it's another example of where I think public radio has excelled in some cases, and where the internet has been helping it figure it out. I won't take long on this, because actually I didn't, you know, with this crowd, most of you actually are pretty familiar with PRX, but I'll do the quick tour. It launched in the fall of 2003, where these have been the three areas of focus for us: content, distribution, and innovation. Our mission really is to harness technology to bring compelling content to millions of people. We do it primarily through working with local stations and independent producers. And one of the sort of tensions for us has been, as audiences are clearly just wanting to grab content wherever they can find it, and as producers, particularly national producers, see the opportunity to go directly bypassing, quote-unquote, stations, what's our role as PRX as a distributor, where on the one hand we've had this kind of equal attempt to create a marketplace serving both independent producers and stations, but independent producers are often frustrated by stations' unwillingness to take their content because they have very tight windows, and so they just want to get out to all platforms possible. They're posting stuff on SoundCloud. They're posting it on their own blogs. They're sticking it directly up on podcasting. Granted, those audiences are much smaller often than a single broadcast would get them. But guess what? It's sort of an immediate effect. And so we've been constantly over the years, and increasingly now, figuring out what PRX's role that is to help independent producers do that. At the same time, as we help stations, and we think this is imperative, create distinctive programming offerings locally that they can't do if they only have to produce everything themselves. So in addition to the tens of thousands of shows that we have that are self-distributed through the marketplace, we now have what we think of as signature shows. And this is an interesting phenomenon where we've now helped cultivate and grow a number of what we think of as shows that exemplify a new voice, a new approach, in some cases a new business model, and in many cases a model where we're trying to break out of the notion that public radio has often had of cooking up a big idea, assuming that CBB might fund it as a research and development project for piloting for 2 years for millions of dollars, audience testing it and releasing it, and then hoping that it'll have enough funding to gain audience over 4 years before it starts. That just ain't going to work anymore. And so shows like this, like 99% Invisible, are in a way the analogy to the lean startup model, except for content. So iterate, be agile, put something out, get users to test it, give you feedback, improve it immediately, adjust and pivot as you need, identify a niche. It's amazing to look actually sort of at the list of things that are tactics for web startups who are being smart about leveraging technology in the cloud and keeping costs low. I think in the podcast domain and what public radio can begin to grab onto and in some ways has already fostered, the lean podcast startup mode is one that we're going to start to see a lot more of. Hard thing being, you know, this one, you know, being a great example, you know, if you can, what's the level you have to reach as a direct audience to make it sustainable? And assuming you can't get grants, I'd like to hear some discussion on that. So the other role we play is in distribution. The marketplace itself now has grown. So, you know, the PRX marketplace, and I gather the session earlier today for the TV distribution, sort of hyper-local television distribution, raised this question. You know, the PRX marketplace is broadcast quality audio content tens of thousands of pieces now being sent through Amazon servers, but then ultimately pushed as a broadcast file to a local station for download. It's worked. It's continuing to grow. It's a limited universe because we're talking about a couple hundred stations who operate this way. But the interesting thing has been that the universe of producers has dramatically increased. There is no such thing as a card-carrying independent producer. We have museums, we've got nonprofits, we've got international broadcasters, we've got high school students, all who are now realizing that audio as a production path makes sense, and CPRX as a pathway to potential broadcast, and that's still a huge draw. So even as they can see that they can put out their blogs and put it out onto audio widgets, the potential to get on broadcast and radio is huge, and there are not enough invitations in public radio to bring them in, although we're trying to fix that. PRX Networks ends up being a private label PRX that supports a number of essentially local journalism centers. And then Public Radio Remix. How many people have listened to Public Radio Remix? Ooh, okay. We got like 12, 13 people, which is great. That's not bad. It's still starting. We're just getting going. But Public Radio Remix, I want you to listen to it because we're looking for your feedback, and I'm hopeful that this is actually a new model and a format that, that could both have lessons for others who are trying to create niche kind of channels, and just, you know, a showcase for great content. So the notion of this is it's curated by Roman Mars, who assembles out of thousands of pieces a stream, like you heard that little promo, which goes into a shuffle mode, so there isn't any schedule, but it ends up being the serendipitous surprise around great stuff that has been handpicked as story-driven audio. And then we push it up onto satellite radio on XM, and out as an internet, a mobile stream, and now offered to local stations. So the last area is innovation, and I'll move beyond this to say, and for PRX, this has been primarily in mobile. So mobile apps in the last couple of years has been a huge piece of what we do. It makes sense in that actually audio mapping to mobile, somebody used the sort of somewhat tired but obvious notion that this is a transistor radio. That's a dumb way to use it, but it actually works really well as a radio just to get audio and have it go with you and have it all be on demand. When we built the public radio player, which now has 4 million downloads, it has all streams of public radio in it, all programs on demand, all aggregated in one device, in one app, slimmed down to be at the, just on your finger, which is kind of a remarkable thing that wouldn't have been possible before. And we think grows the audience at the same time as it has some disruptive tendencies. So, in the area of innovation, two more projects before I move on to the mission question. The Talent Quest. Anybody submit audio to the Talent Quest? All right, we actually had one person there. That's great. So it was a couple years ago now, something we think should continue. It was an open call for hosts of public radio shows. 1,400 people submitted 2-minute-long entries to try to audition to be a host. CPB supported the winners of that, and they now each have national shows that are being distributed. It's a beautiful cycle, I think not well repeated in commercial media or in internet terms for the most part, where there's this embrace of the system as a whole to showcase the best talent. And then a participatory model that is inviting the audience to actually join in as content creators, not just as somebody to respond to or comment on something. The project that we launched just yesterday is called the Public Media Accelerator. So this one is worth a whole session unto itself, so I'm not going to talk about it much now, although I will give you a forward promotion that just at 6 o'clock upstairs we'll have the new director of this hanging out and answering questions about how it'll work. But in a way, the Public Radio Talent Quest was a talent search for new hosts for public radio. The Public Media Accelerator is a talent search for what we say are mission-driven entrepreneurs who, as technologists and visionaries, are ready to build the tools and products and companies that we think are necessary for the next generation of public media services. So it's actually an investment fund that PRX is operating of Knight Foundation money. Over the next couple of years, we have $2.5 million to begin investing in these new companies. And we're here at the conference hoping for pitches about things that you think actually could be built very much as startups that might take this all forward. So, moving in to segment B. That was about the right amount of time for segment A, I think.
Listen.
This is Public Radio Remix.
Using a person's name in a conversation acknowledges their identity, massaging their ego, and hence boosting their self-esteem.
George Tenet, welcome to Fresh Air.
All I'm saying is this, Terry, I went back and reflected. I'm saying, Terry, here's the distinction. Terry, I have to tell you. Well, look,
or,
Terry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Look, Terry, my thoughts on that. The issue for me, Terry, is,
George Tenet was the director of Central Intelligence from 1997 to 2004.
But be careful when using their name. If you use it too much, then you may well appear to be attempting to manipulate them, which is likely to have the reverse effect that desired.
Context removed. Content remixed.
You're listening to Public Radio Remix.
So we get those interstitials going all day long. It's really fun, and we keep new ones coming. So that was my interstitial in the clock. Okay, so I want to go through some of these and send me some of your annotations. This notion about have a mission. I was looking at, Twitter recently restated its mission. And it's actually interesting, even in itself, that these internet companies, some of them, want to have stated missions that go beyond their kind of business case. Twitter restated it as their mission being to instantly connect people everywhere to what's most important to them. Google, as you know, in addition to do not do evil, or do no evil, is it don't be evil? It's don't be evil. Their actual stated mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, which sounds pretty good. NPR, which uses language that I think a lot of public media companies and organizations share, says it's to create a more informed public, one challenged and invigorated by a deeper understanding and appreciation of events, ideas, and culture within the United States and across the globe. So when I think about this, have a mission as a sort of as one of the lessons distilled or the opportunities for public radio that teach something or to have something that might be offered to the internet, I do think it's unique and interesting that in our field we don't just have one individual or one company that has a mission, but we have an entire industry with a shared mission. I've been struck over the years going to public radio conferences that actually is top of mind. It comes out first. It's not sort of left in the dust. It's used sometimes as a crutch and sometimes as this sort of like easy way to just get to everybody's kind of shared commitment. But I think it's fundamental. And when I go to the sessions usually down the hill and hear some of what's going on in the sort of swirl of chasing internet audience and internet dollars, I really miss hearing this. And I've gotten kind of inured to it by going to too many public broadcasting conferences. But when you go outside of that context, you really start missing the feeling that people who are building the new tools that are affecting how people live their lives are doing it often without a mission, or the mission is just baked into the commercial success of their enterprise. And the internet, I think, having started itself as a more of a non-commercial, neutral network, itself is not an organization or an industry. It can't have a mission that it states. But I think those who are building into it on top of it should be increasingly thinking of the mission that supports it, and supports it in a way that's akin more to public media's mission than to some of the others. I always found it interesting. We would go to the Public Radio Program Directors Conference. Anybody been to a PRPD? They carry around laminated cards that have the core values on them. I don't know if they still do that, but they actually laminate the cards and they stick them in the pocket. They're nice to hear. Like, they have love of lifelong learning, substance, curiosity, credibility, accuracy, honesty, respect for the listener, idealism, humor, inspiration, civility, generosity, and often about the craft of a uniquely human voice and conversational and authentic. It's interesting to look at, you know, some of the things when you look at the what succeeded in, for example, blogging and self-expression on the internet, much of that is actually true, and the authenticity is there certainly, and the honesty in many ways is more than you get when you hear a very reported voice on public radio. But as a whole, I think some of those qualities, when we see the worst of what the internet can do, are missing, and nobody's usually, as a service, trying to actually elevate them. I just came from earlier this week, I went to a conference several of us went to called Truthiness. It was the Truthiness Conference at the Berkman Center, which was getting right at this nature of what to do about misinformation and actually some intentional undermining of fact online and how pervasive and powerful it is and who's building anything that might actually guard against it and how overmatched the fact-checking websites and services are when they actually have to contend with that. And it led me to that same, I'll show the same quote that I showed earlier, which I really like, from David Weinberger, from his book called Too Big to Know, about the nature of information that's radically changed on, in the online environment, where he says, this is an awesome time to be a knowledge seeker, you know, because everything's at your fingertips. If you already are someone who's in your personality, in your makeup, you know you want to go seek knowledge, then it's never been better. You've got all the experts at your fingertips. You've got Wikipedia articles up the wazoo. You know, it's all there. But it's also the best time in history to be a complete idiot, which is also true. You know, if our job in part in public radio is to educate, I don't know that we reach deep enough to actually change the quality of whether somebody is a complete idiot or a knowledge seeker, and we tend to cater just to the knowledge seekers. And this is a role that public radio and public media could be playing better as a curator and mediator between those worlds. So, moving on. I want to say also that one of the things that when I was asking this question of people coming to this session about have a mission as a possible thing that public radio can teach the internet, somebody made a policy case, which was that we should remind people who are building enterprises on the internet that they actually have a stake in its governance. So public radio has had fights about this recently because of the federal funding fight, and there's very much awareness that there's a notion of some stake and ownership of the public and responsibility. But the internet, people are sort of assuming it's there forever, and either commercial companies are going to help make it better. But the SOPA and PIPA fights that just happened recently and other ones have begun to light up the notion that internet developers and people building businesses have a deeper stake in the policy around the internet. So someone who I was talking to about this role said, make sure to mention that that's a public radio lesson for the internet, which is to have a stake in its governance. Realize that you actually need to preserve and protect the things that have kept it open. So that was interesting. So, tell a story. This one's good. Let me play a little clip. So, one of our podcasts that we like to hear on Remix Radio is The Memory Palace. Anybody listen to The Memory Palace? This is good. Let's hear a little clip.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMayo. I think the coolest thing about Ben Franklin isn't that he invented bifocals or flew the kite or charted the jet stream or loved the ladies or invented the urine catheter or invented a musical instrument that sounded like this. Or that he started the first volunteer fire crew, or that he's in the Chess Hall of Fame, or that he designed that kick-ass join or die poster with a snake cut up into parts representing each colony, or that he tried to change the alphabet so words could be spelled like they sounded. No. The coolest thing about Ben Franklin is that when he went to Europe during the Revolutionary War to get support from the French, he was so famous, and his electricity experiments were so groundbreaking, that there were people in Britain who were terrified of him. People who thought that if he could fly a kite and trap lightning in a jar, then he was probably actually in France sharing with the king's other mortal enemy some sort of secret weapon, some sort of electrical death ray. Because here was a guy who had harnessed the power of nature.
All right, it gets better, but I'm going to force you to go find the podcast. It's really good. But the notion is story. So certainly on the internet, people are telling stories, but often they're not, and often it's just a mess, and it's like sort of shared fragments and thoughts and not a lot of formation around it and not a lot of intentionality around forming and crafting and researching and also trying to find authentic voices that you then bring forward. And I think this is a public radio asset. This is where we excel. And this is where I'd love to see more innovation happen around it. You know, the ones that are sort of at the top of the list for us that we talk about a lot and we hear when we go to the Third Coast International Audio Festival, but our co-founder, Jay Allison, the work he's done in things like This, I Believe, and Lost and Found Sound, and what he showcases on Transom, the work of the Kitchen Sisters, the work of Joe Richman and Radio Diaries, Dave Isay and StoryCorps, Radiolab, of course, This American Life, Planet Money, Snap Judgment, Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information, I would shout out to. Let's listen to it a little bit.
I think at this point, even the most casual news consumer has run across a lot of stories like this.
The focus of the European debt crisis moved today.
Where time is running out. Here's what would happen if the Eurozone fails.
Tomorrow, there'll be a unified statement of support for these European countries to come
up with this
crisis
ongoing in Europe, setting the stage for investing in...
Well, so I am joined now here in the studio with somebody who actually understands economics and knows about this kind of thing, Alex Bloomberg of the Planet Money team and our staff. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Alex... I think I speak for all Americans when I ask you this question, and that is, do I have to care about this?
I am so glad you asked.
I'm not going to play the rest of that. But brilliant stuff. I've listened and read as much about that. I mean, I can't stand reading about the Greek debt crisis. It's been really hard for me to penetrate. This show explained it to me in a way that I think lots of people are finding is a kind of a storytelling approach around explanatory journalism that public radio, partly because of the human voice and the kinds of excellent storytellers like Ira and the Planet Money team who do this, I think are now sort of establishing a new method that I think is powerful and could be broadened, imitated, and is being imitated, I think, in a good way by others.
Welcome to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. My name is Glenn Washington, and here's a tip. If you decide to move to Japan, do not do so if you only have $248.57 to your name. It's not a lot of yen. But if you do decide to move over there with your empty pockets, don't waste your precious minutes hanging out at the bar with your good time buddies, listening to them tell you how you need to get a job. Thanks for the news flash, fellas. I'm racking my brain one afternoon. I go back to Roach Motel and the...
Yeah, it gets better again, but you're going to have to go listen to that. Otherwise, we'll be here all day. Glenn Washington, one of the winners of the Talent Quest, a sound that we don't hear enough in public radio, but he's got both the stories, the approach, but he does it, as he says, storytelling with a beat. He's one of these unique people who falls in love with and has loved the public radio storytelling mission. But comes from a completely other approach for how he does it, and has formed a team like no other to help him produce that. I think that I'll play one more.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
I have this habit of walking into any door that's unlocked, and it actually does me well here in the Capitol because you start poking around and going into doors and you find the coolest things.
You have to appreciate the moxie of someone who can wander around a federal building, open up a random door, and announce to whoever's on the other side.
Hello. Hi, I'm Andrea Seabrook with NPR.
If you didn't catch that, that's NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook.
I'm a reporter. We're poking around looking at secret things in the Capitol.
I am so in love with Andrea Seabrook right now.
The woman on the other side of the door tells Andrea that she needs to leave and that walking into random doors in the basement of the U.S. Capitol building is not what she's supposed to be doing.
And that's 99% Invisible's own Sam Greenspan. He went with Andrea to the Capitol building. I'm so jealous of him right now.
That's not what we're supposed to be doing.
That doesn't deter you, though.
No. Are you kidding? I don't care what they think I'm supposed to be doing. I'm here to cover the United States Capitol. And frankly, I see this as part of it.
That's pretty great. So again, there it is. Those are the qualities I want to see more of and hear more of and find more of. It's storytelling. It's curiosity. It's great that there's a reporter, an NPR reporter, saying, I don't care what they think. My job is to find things out. And of course, Roman treating it in this way that just draws you in. So I love that. I could listen to it all day long, and I think many people should. And I feel like that also leads to this notion of the power of sound. So it's not just story. So story is the overall arching thing, but I think sound has something to do with it. And it's this thing, certainly our co-founder Jay Allison talks about this well. He did a benediction where he brought it up in fundamental terms. You know, reminded us that hearing is the first of our senses. It's the one to be switched on in the womb, and it is deep and primitive. And especially in the sort of buzz of the internet world and what we see is in front of our screens, it latches on. You know, he says, you know, we don't have ear lids. It gets in and it sticks with you and it comes with you as a parallel experience. And it actually, in many ways, I think, is the new kind of, could be the new navigational user experience of everything we do. The Siri is the next one that's actually starting to become the thing that we now start to imagine is our interface with machines, because we understand the human voice and we have feelings about it. And I think that kind of power of story plus the notion of audio and the way that it can be weaved back into the web. The web started as text. It's hyperlinks. It's, you know, HTML. It's files. The whole metaphor of the web is built around pages and documents and files. We're now shifting, particularly with mobile, I think, back into a place where audio can leap forward and become not just the sort of afterthought that doesn't fit very well on a web page, but something that's actually an entire tier of navigation and of experience and of the way that we think about the world and hear stories. That's an amazing opportunity that only I think we're beginning to see. It's exciting, I think, for people in public radio who sense that opportunity, because many of the things that we were starting to feel are outmoded skills about the quality of craft, about storytelling, about audio production, suddenly are kind of, wait a minute, if we got those things right and figured out the interface for them and the sort of ways that they plug in, those could really change the game. And I think, you know, seeing the success of SoundCloud, even described in sort of fundamental terms as like, we want to put audio, you know, back on the web or make the web native to audio, is great. That's sort of an endorsement, a validation, I think, in the tech space and the startup world, including even the investors who put money into it, saying audio has a centrality that it didn't before. I'm excited about that. So
I'm going to talk about the power of sound.
Jay Allison from Transom.org, speaking at the Third Coast Festival Conference.
You know, a picture you can hold out here, every other thing we experience exists outside us. Sound slips in, it inhabits us. You know, you don't have ear lids and you're defenseless. And it's ghostly. It can alter you, I think, sometimes, because it gets in without your permission, and then you're suddenly somehow changed because you didn't have a chance to protect yourself against it.
That was that. Curating. This is actually, you know, the curate is like the buzzword of the internet. So it's not something public radio uniquely does, but I think it does it in a way that might be compelling to talk about for a bit. So curating is so much the buzzword that there's a book. There's Curation Nation is out. I also have a domain name for sale, by the way, also, which is curate with the number 8 .com. I'm taking bids. I've gotten a few offers online for it, but I think it's pretty good. It has this, in our field, I mean, some of what we've railed against at PRX is the curating in the sense of gatekeeping, because that, you know, is the sort of mediating influence that has kept out and sort of stultified and narrowed in the worst ways, in some cases, the sound and vision of public radio, where we feel like there's a huge diversity of voices and approaches that just aren't allowed onto the formats of public radio, and which has led to things for us like creating Remix as an entire format dedicated to that. But the notion of the DJ in music or the DJ in spoken word is fundamental, and it's one that actually makes the difference now in a world where we're worried about the tensions between the algorithm basically determining our content and somebody with a human editorial touch. In fact, actually, at the night coming up in June at MIT, the night conference that they do each year with the News Challenge, the theme will be the algorithm versus the story, and that's very much this question. You know, that curating role, which we do by necessity when you're managing a limited shelf space broadcast, you know, signal, and you've got gazillions of hours of potential content and audience you have to be careful about losing. You have to play that curatorial really tightly. On the web, that role doesn't scale editorially. So that's where algorithms have come in, and we've basically been trusting, you know, Google to devise algorithms that do the curating for us. And a huge theme, I'm sure, here at the conference, and it's one that hopefully you've been picking up on, are you know, books like The Filter Bubble, concerns around echo chambers, the amazing extent to which personalization now determines our own experience on the web. I feel like the mission-driven opportunity of human curation is something public radio does extremely well and the internet does extremely poorly, and is another, essentially, a metaphor that I think about when I say, what is it that we say when we want public radio to be informing how internet models work? I'm going to move along because, surprisingly, we're getting close to the end here. So broadcast, part of this for broadcast is not the technology of broadcast, but the forced notion that actually we, because we were a broadcast business, have to think about the public as the public, not just as a embarrassment of little niches that we're trying to reach. So, you know, the contour of a station signal basically determined its local service by accident. So however many watts you can put out, suddenly that becomes the public. And you're then forced to figure out how you're talking to that audience. The internet goes the opposite direction, which is it says you can basically decide you're going to talk to the, you know, left-handed, red-headed people who are obsessed about, you know, fiction books from Japan, and that's your niche, and it works really well, and you can create something around it. And you lose something with that. And there's not a lot of incentive on the internet to think about it any other way. It's very hard to think about broadcasting on the internet because the business models don't support it, and the technology allows you to do so much more niche. But I love the idea that that's actually something we could rethink as we use the metaphor of broadcasting and trying to reach a public. The other element of broadcast that I love is live, which is another internet thing I think we miss. As everything goes on demand and asynchronous. Public Radio doesn't do a terrific job of live, although we do some. I love the live local shows when they actually are live. But the liveness, I think, is something we can now think differently about as we move into devices and mobile. One of the little features we put in the This American Life iPhone app that we pushed for was that it has a countdown clock so that when the show is first broadcast live on Friday nights at 8 o'clock from Chicago, everybody who has the app has a little countdown clock that then turns on the show all at the same time on their phones so that they could be listening simultaneously. It's silly. Why? I mean, they don't need to. The show is going to be on demand. But there's something about the synchronous live experience of other people having a shared moment that actually is really powerful. It's been powerful forever, and we're losing it on the internet except for a few moments. So I want to recapture it. All right.
What I've learned.
I'm going to skip that and just switch to the last one and play this.
Hello, this is Alec Baldwin from television. You've heard of television, the dominant broadcast medium of our age. And I've come here to your public radio station during your sad little pledge drive with a simple message. Don't give. Public radio, with its lack of hot buxom starlets, its diluted sense of seriousness, its pathetic faith that ideas still matter, it has no place in today's media landscape. So please, this pledge drive, don't give. Let public radio sputter and die a slow, underfunded death. Let's end this experiment at broadcasting from a sense of mission and civic purpose. Let's return all radio in this country to its proper mission, which is selling advertising and making money. To all of you who have not pledged, my brothers, in this sacred struggle, I salute you. You listen day in, day out, and you never give. Nice work. This pledge drive, please keep that up. Help me destroy public radio. This pledge drive, do what most of your fellow listeners do. Nothing. Do not call now. Do not donate online. Here's someone to give you instructions on how to pledge, which you should ignore.
There you go. That was terrific. That was WNYC, I think, produced that one. Is that right? Let's give them a round of applause. So that has it all in a nutshell, of course, because he gets the mission in this completely funny way. And he reveals something public radio does extraordinarily well, although it's painful as all hell to have to live through when we go into pledge drives. But, you know, for those, when I talk to people who are sort of internet startup types trying to mimic a model of donation or figuring out how to give stuff away for free and build loyalty, the decades of science that have gone into figuring out how to actually motivate people to, even though it's 10% of them, give for something they get for free is kind of incredible. And hasn't yet been unpacked and transferred in ways that I think the internet could gain from. The lessons of creating exceptional, essential, absolutely irresistible content, which is the only way to succeed on the internet now. It has to be unbelievably good stuff, because everything else will compete with it. To do that, have people listen and use it loyally, and then ask them for money is something that should work forever. So we've reached the full hour. I want to thank you for sitting through my kind of rambling rant about why I love public radio, why I love the internet, why I think they should be learning more from each other. Feel free to tweet me, which several of you have been doing, but I didn't get time to read them. Drop me an email and come upstairs because we're going to have a drink. Thank you.